Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. We've got a great episode today. I'm speaking with Nick Seabrook. He's a professor of political science and public administration at the University of North Florida. He's got a great book out. It's called One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America. As we get closer and closer to the 2022 midterms and, of course, the 2024 election, and as we lie in the wake of big decisions like the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, the topic of gerrymandering, electoral reform, and representation is incredibly relevant. So it's great to have this conversation with Nick. We're definitely going to start having these politically focused episodes more and more often. I definitely would like to hear what folks think about this episode and just the topic of gerrymandering in general. Sagar is a little less interested in this topic, thinks it's kind of inconsequential in comparison to the broader issues in America today. If that's your perspective, Nick and I directly talk about that on this episode. So this is also going to be one Sagar and I will discuss during the Friday discussion episode that we're going to record later this week. Couple quick notes before we get in. One, would love for folks to subscribe to the Supercast. You not only help us support the show as we've increased the 3 episodes a week, but you also help us actually up-level our YouTube, pay our staff, really do everything we need to do to make The Realignment the best podcast you could imagine going into the 2024 election. That said, you also get access to bonus content like, for example, tomorrow's bonus episode where I'm bringing my dad, Dr. Mark Trexler, on to discuss the follow-up I long ago promised to the episode with Alex Epstein about energy and climate change. A bunch of folks disagreed and wanted me to ask for a alternative voice to Alex. My dad was one of them, so because he has a background in the climate change space, I decided to bring him in. That is normally an episode that'll be for subscribers only, but because it's my dad and folks want to sort of get to know me better, get to know the show better, I thought this would be the perfect example of something to unlock for everyone else. All that said, lots of great stuff here. We'd love to hear from people, of course, so you can email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com. A huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you all tomorrow. Nick Seabrook, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Great to chat with you. I want to start a little more meta, and then we'll get into the gerrymandering topic. But as I was reading your book, listening to a couple podcasts you went on, I kept thinking, man, I'm experiencing democracy threat overload right now. I think I feel this as a podcaster. I'm sure our listeners feel this too. There's gerrymandering. There's the Supreme Court. There's the Electoral College. There's open primaries, there's closed primaries, there's all these issues that we're consistently having to think about as there's this articulated argument that the democracy is under threat. What do you just think about that idea right now, this idea that there are so many things that we're forced to keep track of that it gets harder and harder to take seriously the idea that there is just this overarching threat?
Yeah, it is unfortunate that we are kind of bombarded from all sides right now with these arguably existential threats to our democracy. And it's understandable that people can kind of feel a little bit of fatigue from that at times. And when every election is supposedly either going to be the saving or the destruction of America, people tend to tune some of those things out. What I think makes gerrymandering in particular something that we should be paying attention to is not only because of the threat that it poses to democracy, to democratic norms, to democratic institutions, but the fact that gerrymandering operates to obstruct change, to obstruct reform, to prevent us from doing other things that we may want to do within our political system. There's been a lot of focus recently with the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs, the decision in Bruin on gun control, as to why our electoral institutions are not pursuing the kinds of policies that seem to have the support of a sizable majority of Americans. And I think part of the reason for that is that the effects of gerrymandering kind of serve in a lot of ways to sever that link, to sever the responsiveness between representatives in government and the constituencies whose interests they are supposed to be paying attention to and reflecting. When politicians know that their district is a safe seat and to get reelected, all they have to do is please the primary constituents who are within their own political party. When those in power know that their majority is safe and is not going to be threatened when they fail to kind of place their finger on the pulse of public opinion and to pursue policies that a majority of the public supports, it creates this situation where government is not responsive. And that, I kind of think, is the major component of gerrymandering that makes it not only a threat in and of itself, creating a system of government where those who are in power are not necessarily the ones who have the greatest level of popular support, but it prevents our political system from achieving other things, whether it's addressing other threats to democracy, election subversion, voter suppression, access to the franchise, or whether it's pursuing policies that are supported by a majority of Americans. Gerrymandering is an obstacle to all of those things. And it's one that, unless we are able to overcome, is going to prevent government from doing a whole host of other things that we might wish that it was doing.
So I want to understand this then, given based on what you're saying. So what you are suggesting here is that an effective way to determine the health of our democracy is whether or not we are able to, not instantaneously, but over a certain time frame, implement whatever the majority will would be. Is that a good way of summing it up?
Right. At its most basic level, for a democracy to be functional, at the very least, the people need to be able to identify that they are unhappy with what the people in power are doing, the policies that they are pursuing, kind of the throw the bums out sort of mentality, where we're unhappy with the people in power. At the very least, we can replace them with the opposition and hopefully get a significant change in direction. But if you look at, in particular, at the state level, the states where gerrymandering has become endemic, places like Wisconsin, for instance, where over the last decade, there have been multiple elections where Democrats have won the popular vote, but Republicans, due to the influence of gerrymandering, due to the districts that they drew both after the 2010 census and kind of rolled back again after the 2020 census, where Republicans have managed to maintain control of close to two-thirds of the seats in their legislature. And that is the kind of short-circuiting of the mechanism of electoral responsiveness that I'm talking about, that you had a large enough chunk of voters in Wisconsin who decided they were unhappy with what the legislature was doing. A majority of them voted for the opposition party, and Republicans held on to control of close to two-thirds of the seats in the state legislature. And that, I think, is kind of the key element here, that when you don't have that very, very basic level of electoral responsiveness, you don't have the ability for voters to throw the bums out, that causes a whole host of other problems. And that's kind of what we're experiencing right now in places like Wisconsin, in states like my home state of Florida, where we saw a recent gerrymander by Governor Ron DeSantis, and all across the nation as well.
I want to think about this philosophically for a second, because that was the great example of Wisconsin. So two-thirds of the state legislature remains in Republican control, but more than 50% of voters were dissatisfied with the status quo. The gap you're putting forth there is that there is no like direct tie there. I think what a completely honest Republican in the state would probably say is, Nick, I get what you're saying, but the way the Wisconsin Constitution is written, the way our system of democracy, saying that colloquially, is set up, we vote for individual representatives, and then as a collective whole, that constitutes who is in charge of the state legislature. So they would basically say, you could say that the popular vote wasn't reflected or not, but we're not making any of these decisions based off of the popular vote. So what is your response? Because they would basically just question your premise. Like, what is your response to that?
My response would be is that I think that is a perfectly valid position to take in a representative democracy where we have made the choice to elect the people who serve us in government from districts, single member districts that correspond to communities, as opposed to going with some kind of proportional representation type system, as is used in a number of other nations, you're never going to have the overall popular vote kind of perfectly correspond to the percentage of seats that one or the other party wins in government, nor should we expect it to. The key concern that I have is that we have a process for drawing districts that is really not found anywhere else in the world. And I kind of frame this dilemma in the book as we've kind of created a system where the foxes are in charge of guarding the hen house. That's often the metaphor you'll hear used when people talk about gerrymandering. The fundamental conflict of interest is that the people who are making the rules, the people who are drawing those districts, are often the very same people who will then be contesting elections in those seats. And that conflict of interest, the perverse incentives that that creates for those politicians to manipulate that process, is at the core of America's gerrymandering problem. And pretty much every nation has figured out that the way you address this problem is not by throwing the whole system out and starting from scratch and saying, how can we create something that is perfectly representative? It's simply by removing that conflict of interest, by assigning responsibility for drawing districts to those who don't have a direct stake in the outcome of the process. And I think then when you have a fair process, you're still not always going to have fair outcomes. We've seen a number of states turn over control of redistricting to some kind of independent commission, whether it's a citizens commission like they use in California and Colorado and Michigan, or some kind of other independent commission made up of experts who are not selected by politicians themselves. This at least creates a process where it's fair and where the incentives don't create a situation where those in control are going to do whatever they can to kind of place their thumbs on the scale. That when you leave those foxes in charge of guarding the hen house, you can threaten them, you can cajole them, you can create remedies where you can sue them if they do things unfairly, but ultimately those incentives, those perverse incentives, the temptation to put their thumbs on the scale ends up being too strong. So kind of my response to that argument is that, sure, it's a representative democracy. It's not a pure democracy. It's a system where the people have the opportunity to vote for representatives. Those representatives are not always going to perfectly reflect the breakdown of public opinion, but at the very least, they should have to pay attention to public opinion when it comes to running for re-election. At the very least, how the people vote should be the primary determinant of who ends up controlling a state legislature or who ends up representing a particular district. You can create a system where it functions and where you have that level of responsiveness, even while maintaining the notion of representatives being connected to a district and being elected by constituents, as opposed to some kind of at-large or proportional representation system.
And the key thing that I'm taking away from what you just said here is that the key, and you were giving the Wisconsin example because it really illustrates a example of the issue. But it seems to me what you're saying here, it isn't literally that the big tragedy in American politics right now is that sometimes you'll have more people vote on one side or the other, but yet the side that got less votes in total ends up in control. The issue is one of the building blocks for that status quo was, to quote you from the book, not merely voters selecting their politicians, but politicians picking their voters. If that wasn't happening, the Wisconsin situation would not be as pressing. Is that a good way of understanding what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And I talk a lot in the book about how, while gerrymandering has been something that has always happened in the United States, even going back to the founding era, even going back to colonial times, it's been this ubiquitous byproduct of having a district-based system, but also a system where redistricting itself is conducted by the political branches of government. But the threat that gerrymandering poses to democracy today is much more severe than I think it has ever before been in US history, simply because of the developments in technology, the sheer amount of data that is available on individual Americans, their preferences, how they might be inclined to vote in elections. But also because we've become a lot better at predicting things moving forward. If you look at some of the historical gerrymanders that I talk about in the book, they were fairly ineffective a lot of the time, because what the powers that be were doing were looking at what happened in the last election and essentially assuming that things would kind of continue forward linearly on that trajectory. And so often, an election or two down the road, the distribution of voters would have changed significantly. You would have perhaps a wave election one way or the other. And suddenly these districts that had been drawn based on how people were voting in the prior decade were looking very different. And there was a lot of possibility for the situation to change moving forward. Whereas today we not only have access to all of this sophisticated data, we also have these models that we can use to simulate what might happen in future elections. So today, the way that redistricting works is that you can draw a particular configuration of district boundaries in a state and then plug those districts into a simulation and see what happens if a couple of elections down the road you have a rash of incumbent retirements and you have these open seat elections. What is the likely effect of that going to be in the individual districts? And you can build in a margin to ensure that you get to keep hold of that seat under those plausible future scenario. You can, and this is why the Wisconsin gerrymander was so successful, they built in enough wiggle room that they could forecast and say, well, what happens if the Democrats win the popular vote by a reasonably significant margin somewhere down the road? How safe do we have to make these districts in order to ensure that that kind of swing is not going to be enough to tip the balance in the legislature overall? And that's kind of been the major shift that we've observed in gerrymandering over the last couple of decades, that the methods have become a lot more sophisticated. The data has become much more granular. And you have the ability now to tweak a gerrymander to the point where it can, or it has a much greater likelihood of remaining robust throughout an entire decade, as happened in Wisconsin. And the issue with that is that this is kind of a once in a decade process. Every 10 years, we get new census numbers. All of the states have to redraw their districts to account for changes in population. And if the party that controlled redistricting a decade ago managed to create something that was durable enough that they're still in the majority a decade later, they get to redraw the districts again. And that's kind of a new development. A lot of the historical gerrymanders were effective for maybe a few elections, but the ones that we're seeing today are holding up for an entire redistricting cycle. And it can kind of create a situation where you have effective single party rule in a state where the same party controls the legislature decade after decade, and they've drawn the districts in such a way that that majority, no matter how the people vote, is never going to be seriously threatened.
What I like about both your book and your framing is that, and I was hinting at this when I opened the show with this democracy threat overload question, is that there's just a very direct tie between what you're claiming and this issue of democratic principles not being fulfilled. So A, the polling on this issue is pretty clear. I can't remember the exact numbers, but most people, when you ask them the question, should the person you're voting for determine the boundaries of the district, most people are like, yeah, that doesn't make that much sense. So there's the public will on the question. And then there's just the very fact that a good way of summing up what's different about now than a previous era, aside from just the technology bit, is that it seems like there's this huge, not seems, this is true, there's a huge lack of trust in government. There's a huge lack of responsiveness to public will. So the tech and just like the broader societal narrative are really clashing together. So I'd love for you just gave this, the tech example. Can you just talk about, you know, you, in the previous podcast, you talked about how you're a political junkie and think about these questions. Like, how would you just sum up like the status quo in America right now if it's playing into this gerrymandering issue?
Yeah, I think the issue that we have is that polarization kind of infects so many elements of our politics, not just questions over policy, over whether Congress should pass legislation to protect abortion rights, or whether we should see reform on gun control, or any of a host of different areas where people want government to be taking action to address the problems in our society. But polarization also kind of bleeds into these more fundamental debates about the rules of the game. And I talked at the beginning about the idea that polarization has kind of created this situation where the stakes are always unimaginably high. When Democrats, Republicans are not just the opposition, they're not just people who disagree with you on policy, they're the enemy. They're the ones who, if you're a Republican, Democrats want to destroy the American way of life. They want to fundamentally transform our society. They want to dismantle capitalism. If you're a Democrat, Republicans want to end American democracy. They want to create a situation where they can just install Donald Trump as president in 2024, no matter how people vote. They want to disenfranchise through voter suppression those who disagree with them. And when people have these perspectives, first of all, it removes any room for compromise. When the stakes are the destruction of the American way of life or the destruction of democracy, there's not a whole lot of common ground between the two sides on that question. And so polarization, I think, is at the root of the destructive effects that gerrymandering is having right now, because and we've seen it this time around with both Democrats and Republicans when they've had the opportunity, really pushing the boundaries of what they can achieve through gerrymandering, whether it's Republicans here in Florida or in Texas or in a state like Wisconsin, or whether it's Democrats in New York or Maryland or the state of Illinois. Both sides are pushing the boundaries because it's become about winning at all costs. It's become about preventing the other side from doing things that are truly destructive. And it's kind of hard to see a way out of that situation. I tried not to be too pessimistic in the conclusion of the book. I kind of finished with at least my best effort at a blueprint for how we might get ourselves out of this situation. But ideological polarization is something that does not appear to be going away. In fact, it seems to be getting worse all the time. And there's been a lot of debate among political scientists about why American society is so polarized right now between Democrats and Republicans. And in many ways, it's kind of been, if you think of it in terms of medicine, kind of a diagnosis of exclusion. We know a lot of things that haven't, as far as we understand it, caused this polarization. We know that gerrymandering itself is not the driving factor behind polarization, although it certainly does exacerbate its effects. Things like the role of money in politics, the use of closed primaries where only Republicans or Democrats get to vote. It seems like every time we throw a hypothesis at polarization, it turns out that's really not what's causing it.
Wait, quick thing. So you're saying, just to be very precise here, you're saying that regardless of one's thoughts on the money and politics issue and the closed versus open primary debate, even if you flipped a switch and changed both issues. So let's say like you reverse Citizens United and you passed a constitutional amendment making it so that all primaries are open, the polarization issue would not change. Is that what the political science data shows?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And you could flip a switch and for our next election, we could have no gerrymandering, we could have publicly funded campaigns, and we could have open primaries in every state. And that would not fix the problem of polarization because it's baked into the electorate at this point. And I think there's a level of in a two-party system where you have the rules set up so that and this has been the case pretty much always throughout U.S. history, that the names and the identities of the political parties have changed. But we've always kind of coalesced around this two-party system, which tends to inevitably happen in electoral systems where you have these single-member districts and a plurality of votes is enough to win. Whoever gets the most votes in the district ends up winning that seat. The research suggests that always tends to produce a two-party system. And in a two-party system, those political parties tend to want to distinguish themselves ideologically. They want to offer a different vision from their opponents. And so I think to some extent, polarization is just a natural state of American politics. You can go back to previous eras and we were polarized on the issue of slavery. You get into the late 19th century, Democrats and Republicans were pretty polarized on the question of tariffs. And we kind of had this situation from the New Deal through to around about the 1960s, where we kind of had this break from polarization. You had this ideological or cross-ideological coalition that was established by FDR, where he was able to win the votes both of conservative Southern Democrats and more liberal kind of Union Democrats across the rest of the country. And you had kind of this this sort of artificial New Deal coalition that proved remarkably durable for many decades and kind of, I think, obscured the fact that polarization tends to be a natural state of affairs. But I also think that whatever natural degree of polarization that we have in our system has kind of been put on steroids by the influence of social media. And that's kind of the thing I see as being really different from today's different about today's polarization compared to these historical eras is that you have this mass communication, you have the ability to instantly disseminate these ideas and talking points across social media, And you don't have the kind of gatekeepers of democracy that might have been reflected by the major TV networks or going back by the newspapers. This information is out there and is available to anyone at any time. And it's hard to put that genie back in the bottle. When you have both polarization and the effects of social media, it kind of seems like it's almost impossible to lower the temperature. And I really don't think we have a sense of what a good solution to this problem might be.
Well, it seems that, once again, this isn't it's not the sexy answer and it's not the quick turnaround answer, but it seems like the answer is victory for like one side or the other. So you're talking about, you know, you're referring to FDR's like artificial New Deal coalition that goes through LBJ's Great Society and then the dissent in Vietnam 1968 period. But that's what politics is, like FDR and then multiple Democratic administrations. And then the Eisenhower administration, largely agreeing on many of those questions, were able to just build a coalition that could answer questions in one direction. It seems that right now the issue is neither party has either the political talent at the top or even just like the ideological framework for building a 60 plus one majority coalition. So what do you think about, because that's just the obvious response.
Right. And as you say, it was victory for one side that kind of created that New Deal consensus, that New Deal coalition, but it was a victory that was made possible because of widespread disenfranchisement. The fact that Democrats in the South between the kind of compromise of 1877 all the way through to the civil rights movement were able to systematically disenfranchise minority voters, that kind of enabled the almost kind of taking the issue of civil rights off the table, something that would naturally have divided that Democratic constituency, the kind of more conservative Southern Democrats versus the more liberal Democrats elsewhere. Keeping those divergent ideological coalitions together was only possible because of institutions like Jim Crow. And what we saw is that as soon as the Democratic Party embraced the cause of civil rights in the 1960s under LBJ, that coalition immediately started to fall apart. And it took a number of decades for that realignment to kind of fully materialize at all levels of government. But my concern then would be that victory for either Democrats or Republicans moving forward to the point where polarization might be diminished might come at the similar cost of voting rights, whether it's through gerrymandering or whether it's through election subversion, that victory may come at such a great cost as it did with the New Deal coalition that you're not really in any better of a situation than we are right now with highly polarized ideological opponents.
I guess that's interesting though, because not putting aside, because it's the like obvious elephant in the room of 20th century American politics, but America, especially Black Americans, were better off in 1968 than they were in 1931. So I get your point that let's say one side did win, binary questions are answered one direction or the other. Because I think that, you know, that is from my perspective, and this isn't empirical, but this is just my sense from talking to a lot of people on these different sides of these issues. The reason why everything is so polarized right now and the reason why all these technocratic flip switches, so, you know, it's the open primaries, ranked choice voting, the reason why none of those things would actually make, or money in politics, the reason why it wouldn't make a difference is there are just moments in American history where sometimes there are answers that are one answer or the other. Either there are too many abortions in this country, or it's not easy enough to get an abortion. Not mean to make light of that issue, but like that's basically the debate right now. Either America should have more immigrants or it should have less immigrants. Like, it just seems that right now we've got stacked up 20 different issues where I don't see a way around. Is there too much money in politics, or is there not enough money in politics? Like, I'm struggling to think of nuance, and it seems to me that that seems to be just like the root issue. And reformers, and I think reformers who basically blame everything. I'm not saying you're saying this, but I just see this very easy scapegoating of the two-party system. When basically, okay, if there was a third party, we had Andrew Yang on the podcast, and I said, okay, Andrew Yang, like, who are you going to appoint to your Supreme Court justice? Who are you going to appoint to your Supreme Court? Let's say magically he is like this third party person. Very quickly, let me take a step back, because like this is just my favorite topic. Coalitional politics means that there's only a set number of different coalitional groups in American politics. So even if you add like a third or fourth or fifth or sixth party, there's still the same groupings of people. So if Andrew were to be a third party president, but then have to make a Supreme Court choice, justice choice, when the only thing people basically care about right now is what are your stances on voting rights, gun rights, and abortion rights? Andrew Yang is obviously going to be to the center left of those questions, not the center right. It didn't matter if you added another party. So I mean, what's just your response to like that? That's my interpretation of the dynamic, but I'm curious what you think about it.
I'm also kind of skeptical about the idea first that a competitive third party is even possible in the electoral system that we have today. I mean, you can look back at all different occasions in US history where you've seen at least some momentum towards a third party, whether it was the Ross Perot campaign in 1992, where he got almost 20% of the vote. And then almost immediately that then fizzles out, or whether it's the Dixiecrats in the 1960s, or going even further back, the attempt by Teddy Roosevelt to kind of form a progressive party, that there are just so many structural obstacles to a third party meaningfully establishing itself. But I also think, and this is, I think, more of the consensus within political science, that generally robust, healthy two-party competition is a good way to run a democracy. You have two major political parties that articulate their vision, their policies, their platforms, and it gives voters a meaningful choice between two different ways forward. It also facilitates, going back to the issue of responsiveness, it facilitates those types of democratic mechanisms. Even in a society where a sizable chunk of the electorate is not paying attention to the day-to-day news in politics, or is not completely on top of every issue that may be getting debated in Washington or in their state capital, most people at least have a sense, whether it's based on economic conditions, whether it's based on their own personal financial situation, what they're seeing in their communities, most people have a sense of whether they're happy with what's going on. And I think the two-party system kind of facilitates that mechanism. At the most basic level, even a fairly low information voter has an opinion about Joe Biden and whether Joe Biden's doing a good job as president. And that's enough to cast a relatively informed vote that is going to meaningfully affect the direction of the nation. You're unhappy with Joe Biden? Vote for Republicans in the midterms. You're unhappy with Joe Biden when and if he runs for re-election in 2024, vote for the Republican candidate. So I think generally a two-party system is a pretty good way to structure a democracy and to create meaningful accountability. You start throwing in additional parties. Some of these multi-party systems have incredibly unstable governments. You have these kind of rolling coalitions where you're relying on the support of four, five, six different political parties in order for a government to remain in power. you see a lot of changes, a lot of instability in those political systems. I think a system where every 2 years people get to vote for their members of Congress, every 4 years they get to vote for president, and they can decide whether they're happy with the status quo or whether they want to change it, is a pretty good mechanism. And the reason why I focus so much on gerrymandering is that it renders even that most basic mechanism of democratic accountability ineffective in a lot of circumstances where a majority of people in a state may be unhappy with the governor or the legislature, but that may not be reflected in what happens in the next election. But I'm certainly not of the Andrew Yang, we need a third party school of thought. I think the best thing is to try and ensure that our existing two-party system functions a little bit better. And we don't have to kind of shoot for the moon on this. We don't need a political system where every voter is fully informed on every issue and are researching all of the candidates. Just that kind of basic feeling thermometer, I like what's going on, I'm unhappy with what's going on, tends to work reasonably effectively in practice.
You know, I want to merge this with the gerrymandering conversation because there's a decent number of third party folks who listen. So I want to not just leave them totally behind here, but what I'm basically hearing from you is a two-party system that is properly responsive solves for many of the issues that good faith third party advocates are really speaking about. Because once again, let's go to these historical examples. The reason why, if you're a progressive, Teddy Roosevelt's attempt to make the Republican Party more progressive isn't a tragedy in terms of his loss, is that Woodrow Wilson was also a progressive. And Woodrow Wilson said, hey, there's this big opportunity to realign the Democratic Party in a different, let's put aside a lot of the other issues Woodrow Wilson realigned on. But in terms of like the economic side of those progressive issues, Woodrow Wilson's like, hey, I mean, he believes these things legitimately, but there's an opportunity to be responsive to those Theodore Roosevelt voters. Then the parties shift their different directions and explains why the Democrats are progressive in the 20s and the Republicans are electing people like Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover. Then in the, you know, 1960s, you obviously have Republicans like Barry Goldwater respond to the fact that a lot of Republicans, a lot of voters didn't like that in the 1950s, there was very little gap. There was less of a gap between the two parties. Like Richard, I just read a book on Richard Nixon and JFK. There wasn't really that much difference between the two of their specific articulations of America. So the political system responded by polarizing the parties a little more. And that was something which was responsive. And then finally, let's look at Trump and Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader's whole thing in 2000 is these two parties are the exact same. Well, that was very quickly responded to. And then if you're Donald Trump, you're saying, oh, wait a second, I'm able to exploit this gap between the establishment and basically conservative voters. My path isn't by running in the Reform Party. It's by running in the Republican Party because the votes are there. So there is just this point where which is more likely to happen, and then I'll take this to you, right? Which is more likely to happen? A complete reconstruction of the American political system so that third, fourth, and fifth parties are viable, or these specific changes like the gerrymandering reforms that have already been passed in states that would make parties more responsive? So here's the actual question then. What lessons can we take from states that have pursued the anti-gerrymandering path you've described? Like, are their politicians more responsive? I don't want to say the political climate is healthier, because to your point, like, this isn't a polarization solver, it's a responsiveness solver. So like, what are our lessons from states that have done this?
Well, just to go back to the point you made there, because I think it's a really good one, that when the parties are smart, they have these massive infrastructures, they know what people are thinking. And so when you have those kind of gaps that you talk about, when there are significant blocks of voters out there who don't see their needs being reflected in either of the main political parties, that creates an opportunity for one of the parties to exploit that, as Donald Trump did. And this is what we see time and again with these third party movements, is that they may have some early momentum, but then they very, very quickly get cannibalized by either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, who then better reflect the underlying constituencies that are there in society. And responsiveness is the mechanism by which this happened. You kind of identify an unmet demand from a certain group of voters, and the political party then shifts its platform to accommodate those voters. And that's kind of what I hope will happen when it comes to the problem of polarization. If you get to the point where there are sufficient numbers in the middle who are entirely dissatisfied with how extreme Democrats are on the left, how extreme Republicans are on the right, there's going to be a natural opportunity for one or both political parties to start looking back to the center. You cannot keep polarizing indefinitely. It's just not a viable political strategy. So it could be that we are kind of at the point where that kind of divergence of the parties has reached its limit. And at some point they will inevitably have to start coming back to the center, because there are sufficient voters there that it becomes a more effective political strategy to appeal, if you're the Democrats, to the likes of Andrew Yang and some of the other more centrist elements in that political party, or if you're the Republicans, to start reaching out and trying to appeal to the kind of never Trump voters who were dissatisfied with the direction that Donald Trump took the party in. So that is something that gives me some optimism, that in a two-party system, there are always incentives for the political parties to look to these unaddressed constituencies. Getting back specifically to gerrymandering, I think that what we've seen from the reforms that various different states have adopted is that the reforms have generally been pretty successful, and you don't need to reinvent the wheel to, at the most basic level, deal with this issue of gerrymandering, because the fundamental problem is the fact that politicians are in control. And this is kind of the solution that pretty much every nation has gone towards over the last century or so. They've figured out that once you make redistricting independent of direct political influence, so you take it away from elected representatives who have a direct stake in the outcome, and you give that authority to some kind of independent entity. So in some countries like Germany, for instance, this is an independent government agency that is responsible for election administration more generally. In other nations like the UK, it's an independent commission that focuses specifically on redistricting and is made up of nonpartisan, basically career bureaucrat type figures who are at least to some extent insulated from political influence, that this gives you a process that won't produce a 100% fair electoral map every time, but will at least remove that influence of politicians who, first and foremost, they want to protect their jobs, they want to maintain their own seats. And the way that they maintain their own seats is by making their districts as safe as they plausibly can. That has the effect of reducing the overall percentage of seats in the system that are competitive. There's been a lot of talk over the last year about how in 2022 we will have the least competitive congressional map ever in terms of individual districts that are plausible targets for both Democrats and Republicans. And that number is something like 35 seats out of the 435 in the House. And that number has been going down for decades now. But when you kind of remove that political influence, Sometimes you may get a map that's a little bit tilted towards Democrats. Sometimes you may get one that's a little bit tilted towards Republicans, but you get a map that has more responsiveness, more competitive seats, and one that is at least more likely to reflect the popular will, as opposed to reflecting the selfish interests of those who were in control of the process.
So something I'm curious about, and this is a awkward tension when we're talking about the state of democracy circa 2022. For good or for ill, a lot of these reforms, I think sometimes this isn't true, but a lot of times this is true, would end up benefiting Democrats. There is in the sense that, in the sense of, if you're a Democrat, your claim right now is that we want action on gun control. We want the abortion status quo to be pushed much more towards what Roe was versus to what these Republican states are doing. We want a different perspective on just all sorts of different issues, money and politics, like whatever. So the whole point is, a Democrat says politics is not responsive because this set of outcomes are not going about. And if we look at those outcomes, they tend to be left-leaning outcomes. Has that historically always been true when we're talking about this issue of like electoral and democracy reform? Because what's just so funny is, because once again, this is a bipartisan audience. I've just found that, you know, almost universally, the right part of the audience loses interest once this gets very specific. Or they say, look, Nick, I agree with your point about responsiveness, but at the end of the day, during this binary, hyperpolarized era, everything you're saying basically just benefits our opponents. Has there ever been an era where it was, let's say, like more liberal folks who would have been harmed in terms of electoral outcomes by reforms such as this?
Yeah, I think that's a really fair point. And this is part of the reason why I wanted to make this book not just an advocacy book about getting rid of gerrymandering, or not just a discussion about what's going on with gerrymandering today. That's why I focused so much on the history, because you're right, this is one of those issues that kind of now has a partisan valence to it. But that's largely a consequence of what happened in the 2010 election. So 2010, you had this kind of perfect storm for Republicans where Obama was pretty unpopular. So you had kind of this GOP wave election that swept them into power in state legislatures all across the nation. And it coincided with it also being the election that would determine who would control redistricting after the 2010 census. And the GOP really capitalized on this with their Red Map initiative. They targeted states where they thought they could use redistricting to get an edge. And I certainly don't mean that to be a criticism that singles out Republicans, because as I talk about in the book, go back to the 1970s and the 1980s, it was the Democrats who controlled the majority of state legislatures. And it was the Democrats who were gerrymandering the districts in places like California, in places like Texas. So I don't think that, I think it's very unfortunate that this has become an issue that kind of breaks down along party lines. I also think there's some encouragement to reference the polls that you talked about at the beginning. It's pretty clear that, based on the evidence that we have, that rank and file Republican voters don't really like gerrymandering all that much either. I think there's kind of an innate sense of fairness that people have, that at the very least, we should have a reasonably level playing field. And Americans, I don't think, generally like the perception that the rules of the game are being manipulated, even if in their state that happens to be benefiting the political party that that they support. It's why when people are given the opportunity to vote on redistricting reform, in the case of ballot initiatives, we've seen redistricting reform initiatives passed in Florida, in Michigan, in California, and in Utah. So swing states, red states, and blue states, when the people have the opportunity to vote on this, it seems like the anti-gerrymandering position is the popular one. I also think that Democrats themselves are, to some extent, responsible for the partisan valence of this issue as well, because they have tended to lump gerrymandering in with some of the other things that they criticize Republicans for, allegations of voter suppression, allegations of election subversion, that Republicans are going to steal elections through complicit local or state officials. And when you kind of lump it together with these other things, and you inevitably give the implication that, oh, this is just one other Republican threat against democracy, that further contributes to the polarization. What I would like to see Democrats do is not only to try and push redistricting reform in at the state level, where it's an option to put a proposition on the ballot for the people to vote for, to do that, but also to reach out across the aisle and to try and make these efforts bipartisan. That's what happened in California. You had both Republican Governor Schwarzenegger and his Democratic predecessor, Gray Davis, come out in support of redistricting reform. I'd also, when it comes to Democrats in Congress, like them to treat redistricting, gerrymandering as its own issue, rather than just one other component that they throw into their omnibus voting rights bills, where there's so much stuff in there that Republicans oppose that there's basically zero chance, absent the abolition of the filibuster, that there's ever going to be bipartisan agreement on those omnibus voting rights bills. But I do think that there's greater potential for bipartisan agreement on redistricting. You can point to states where Democrats have been this decade, more so than last decade, doing the same kind of thing that Republicans have been doing: New York, Maryland, Illinois, some of the states that I've talked about. You can point to the fact that Republican voters are supportive of this as well. And if you were to introduce this as a standalone bill before Congress, I think there's a reasonable chance that you might be able to get something done, that a decade from now, at least when it comes to drawing congressional districts, which is the only thing that Congress actually has jurisdiction over, to require states to turn that over to some kind of independent commission. But as long as redistricting and gerrymandering is kind of lumped together with these other disputes over voting rights and elections that have a high degree of partisan coding to them, it becomes almost impossible to get any kind of significant bipartisan agreement on it.
Yeah, and I just want to close with the compliment to the way you've set up this conversation and even just the book, which is that we get pitched a lot of these books, and yours is actually one of the first I've actually taken, because typically, and this is, I think, more on the publisher side of things, the framing is Trump 2024, democracy's under assault, therefore insert these like technocratic, like kind of like wonky things, where like that is framing this issue, to your point, in a definitionally polarizing way. And any issue that gets framed that way is not going to pass under the current political environment. So what I like about what you've done is you've just taken a step back and said, let's just ask this very straightforward binary question. Should politicians decide who their voters are? Most people, basically, I don't want to be unfair, but that's a very hard to defend argument when it's framed that simply. Versus, let's talk about voter suppression. talked to lots of Republicans about this issue. Well, I'm skeptical of vote by mail, and there could be cheating, and there are so many just addendums that get added that it gets so overly complicated. It doesn't mean that there isn't voter suppression. It doesn't mean there don't need to be things done here. But when you take an issue that I think, based on polling, just the empirics you're talking about, is as straightforward as gerrymandering, and then mixing it into a broader bucket of complicated and honestly kind of more value-based questions. So once again, the question of should it be easier to vote or harder to vote? I could take that two different directions based on my actual ideology versus this question of, look, most people in America tend not to like or trust politicians at a literal level. Therefore, do we trust them to set the boundaries? There's a 60 plus one majority saying, yeah, I'd rather not trust them to do that. So I think it's just an important lesson for how people talk about this democracy voter responsiveness frame that's a little separate from the, let's just say, unproductive. It's not that it can't be true, but it's definitely unproductive to frame the issue that way. So let's just close here, Nick. Could you shout the book out? Listeners, like always, appreciate when they hear it from the author. Full title, all those good things.
Yeah, thanks. And I absolutely appreciate your you taking that away from the book. And that was really been my approach, is to not write a book for Democrats, to write a book for Americans. And so if that came across, then hopefully I achieved what I set out to achieve. The book is One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America. And it's not a book for Democrats or a book for Republicans. It's a book for Americans, because this is an American problem.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.